The Trump administration defended itself by saying that it is only seeking to reform and streamline FEMA. According to the BBC, about one-third of FEMA's workforce has left their jobs in 2025 alone. From WPFW News, I'm Noah Portner.
Good afternoon, this is the Shai Rana Show with your host Zain Al-Amin. This is a show that focuses on Arab culture and politics, and it airs every Wednesday for 1 hour at WPFWFM.org and WBAI-FM. There is a word in Arabic. Sumud. It means steadfast perseverance. Particularly in resistance to the occupation of your homeland. I just want that thing. When voices join in harmony, and in that fleeting moment, when meaning coalesces there, dissolving, clears the alleyways no more. And fresh bread, scent of home, pervades the air. No sandaled soles in dust of broken homes, peep bloody from the garment hem. All the big parades and shock and awe and swagger on the carrier deck, and medals jangle helpless in the face of what is fair. Give me an oh yeah. across the Great Divide. Come men and women, unafraid, to dash in loss their bracelets at the wall. When voices join in harmony, and we turn the final page, when man evolves beyond the crass, and reason comes of age, and dogma and witchcraft and cant and propaganda and Palantir, Lockheed, Grumman and Chevron and Exxon and Pfizer and the oligarchs and mines to say, we're sorry that we done it, mummy. We only done it for the fucking money. Oh yeah. Sleight of hand trump us. We will find 10,000 new voices in every crowd. And when all those new voices join us in harmony, standing shoulder to shoulder, from the river to the sea, people from every nation will hear that joyful sound. Ordinary people just standing their ground, and together these ordinary people, together, they will turn this ship around. Oh yeah. Together.
His new song that he just released, Samud, which means steadfastness in Arabic. And Roger Waters is somebody that has been supportive of the Palestinian struggle forever. I mean for decades now. He doesn't disappoint at all with this song. Next, we're going to hear a clip from Ghadi Francis. Ghadi Francis is a Christian Lebanese activist and journalist who tells the absolute truth. She's one of my heroes. She is, what she's talking about right now is the fact that the U.S. envoy that came to Lebanon, he's actually the ambassador to Turkey. His name is Tom Barak, and he's actually originally a Lebanese, of Lebanese ancestry. And recently he insulted all the Arab journalists that were at the presidential palace in Lebanon by saying that he by basically stating that they're acting in a chaotic way that's animalistic, which is like Orientalism 101. You'd paint Arabs as animals. And of course, there's been an uprising, not just among the journalists for doing that. You know, as one Al Jazeera journalist says, you know, when you hear him, get your Orientalism bingo card out. I love that expression because it checks off everything Orientalism. And for the for those of you who don't know what Orientalism, I'm actually teaching it in a class at AU right now, which is the exotification, demonization, villainization of Arab people to other them, meaning to create them, to recreate them in an image that is that puts them as if they're citizens from another planet, or rather aliens. That way you can oppress them and steal their resources. But the best rebellion in Lebanon right now is the one that's held by the women of South Lebanon, because this thick-skinned diplomat, Tom Barak, wanted to go to South Lebanon right after making these comments, to the city of Tyre, the ancient city of Tyre, which was bombed recently by Israel and was bombed after the ceasefire was announced, which he brokered, and to go to Al-Khayyam, which is the site of the most notorious prison camp that Israel set during its 22-year occupation that ended in the year 2000. So the women basically said that he is not to desecrate this land, that this land is purified, and it's purified by the blood of the martyrs, our sons. And if he were, we're gonna pick up all the stones from the rubble, from the destruction of our homes, meaning those homes that were destroyed by Israel, and use them as weapons if he dares to step foot on our purified land. We'll not let him desecrate it. We will not let him set foot here. And he had to cancel, of course, and retreat. And thankfully, you know, our Lebanese government is just as corrupt as the American government, as, you know, as corrupt as every Gulf nation, as corrupt. And they've been basically collaborating with the U.S. when the U.S. is building one of the biggest embassies in the world on a hill. How that's being allowed, I don't know. But I think there's going to be a shift right now as the rebellion rises and the snake sticks its head out for the public to see what he's about. So let's listen to Ghadi Francis breaking it down about this Tom Barak, U.S. envoy to the Middle East.
Listening to the Electronic Intifada live stream, I'm Ali Abu Nema, here with my colleague Nora Barros-Friedman. Over the last several days, workers at Microsoft, joined by community members and former Microsoft workers, have set up an encampment outside the U.S. tech giant's headquarters to protest its complicity in Israel's ongoing genocide. Let's take a look at a video of those protests shared by the campaign group No Azure for Apartheid.
Brazilian nonprofit Educarte presents a night of Afro-Brazilian culture with Ile Aie percussion and dance ensemble from Liberdade Salvador, Brazil, celebrating its 50th anniversary with a return to Washington, D.C. on Friday, September 5th, 8 p.m. at the UDC Theater of the Arts at 4200 Connecticut Avenue, northwest of Washington, D.C. The performances feature drumming, songs that tell the stories of resistance and hope, and dances inspired by the Orishas and traditions of Candomblé. Details about this Afro-Brazilian celebration in D.C. featuring Ileaye at educarteinc.org, educarteinc.org, or 202-450-8541.
Other clip, which we're gonna, comes from Electronic Intifada, and this is relating to how Silicon Valley is helping Israel's genocide. By the way, if you don't know yet, Microsoft basically stored all the names of the people for the Israeli government that they needed to kill. Basically, Microsoft was directly participating in the genocide by providing all the tech that Israel needed to mass murder Palestinians, especially civilians in their home, to mass murder journalists, to mass murder doctors, to mass murder teachers, professors, poets, writers. And what is brilliant here, what happened in the last week, is that Microsoft employees, the ones that are have retired and the ones that are still working for Microsoft, basically did several actions. For one, they occupied the executive offices of Microsoft. And on also what they did is that they also protested outside, of course, and held an encampment outside of the Microsoft offices. And lastly, and this is my favorite thing, they actually mobilized when they realized that the CEO basically lives on a lake, on this big lake house. And what they did then, that this lake house is only accessible by boat. So what they did is they approached the lake house with dozens of boats that had banners hoisted above them protesting, and therefore you know, basically attacking peacefully, that is, attacking the CEO right at his home where he's resting. There will be no rest for Microsoft executives, I guarantee you. The way it's been going, any kind of public hearing, any kind of address to their employees has been disrupted. But this one is the big one. And I believe the occupation of one of the executive offices is still ongoing. Here in this clip that we're about to hear, we're going to hear Ali Abu Nima talk about interview somebody who is an expert on what Silicon Valley is doing, how they're participating in genocide. And I urge all listeners, for if there's any way possible, you can boycott Microsoft products. I urge you to do it as soon as possible. So with that, let's listen to Ali Abu Nima talking about Silicon Valley's complicity in genocide.
You are watching and listening to the Electronic Intifada live stream. I'm Ali Abu Nima, here with my colleague Nora Barros Friedman. Over the last several days, workers at Microsoft, joined by community members and former Microsoft workers, have set up an encampment outside the US tech giant's headquarters to protest its complicity in Israel's ongoing genocide. Let's take a look at a video of those protests shared by the campaign group No Azure for Apartheid.
Today, we answer let this call to action. Our liberated zone is established out of desperation, urgency, and grief. We grieve alongside Palestinian mothers who have had to bury their star children.
Thousands have been killed as a result of the current iterations of Israel's ongoing Nakba.
Anas al-Sharif, this is my will and final message.
And regular viewers will recall that we interviewed several former and current Microsoft employees involved in this campaign in May, and they told us about the ways the company assists Israel's genocide, including by providing its Azure cloud services to the Israeli military. Campaigners say those protests and disruptions will continue until Microsoft ends its complicity. Microsoft is taking note of the growing unrest over its complicity. Last week, the company announced that it is commissioning an external review of allegations published by The Guardian that the Israeli military is using its Azure cloud service, quote, for the storage of data files of phone calls obtained through broad or mass surveillance of civilians in Gaza and the West Bank. Microsoft said that its standard terms of service prohibit this type of usage and that the review is to be conducted by an outside law firm. But the August 15th statement also says, quote, in recent months, we've heard concerns from our employees and the public about media reports regarding Microsoft's Azure and AI technologies being used by the Israeli military to target civilians or cause harm in the conflict in Gaza. In response, we have conducted an internal review and engaged an external firm to undertake additional fact-finding to help us assess these issues. Based on these reviews, we have found no evidence to date that Microsoft's Azure and AI technologies have been used to target or harm people in the conflict in Gaza. The No Azure for Apartheid campaign has not been impressed, calling Microsoft's announcement of the new external inquiry, quote, yet another tactic to delay the immediate cessation of ties with the Israeli military. The group reaffirmed that there is no ethical, moral, or compliant way to sell technology to an army on trial for genocide led by war criminals wanted by the International Criminal Court. Now, Microsoft is one of several U.S. big tech firms deeply intertwined with Israel, and they include Google, Amazon, Dell, and Meta, among others. Our guest today is someone who follows the role of big tech in this genocide closely. He is Omar Zahzah, Assistant Professor of Arab, Muslim, Ethnicities, and Diaspora Studies at San Francisco State University. I'm also proud to say he is a regular contributor to the Electronic Intifada, and his most recent article, published in July, revealed previously unknown details about Dell's extensive ties to the Israeli military during this genocide. Omar is the author of Terms of Servitude, a groundbreaking book published by Seven Stories Press, documenting how digital platforms and tech companies based in the United States support Israeli settler colonialism and genocide through active collaboration and censorship. It's available for pre-order now and will be released next month. Omar, welcome to the Electronic Intifada live stream and congratulations on the publication of Terms of Servitude. I read the whole book yesterday. I sat down and read it cover to cover. It's really an incredible book, and you deserve real congratulations on this achievement, especially trying to remain focused on writing a book amid this genocide, which, as you say in the book itself, was an extremely difficult task to do emotionally and practically. So really, it's an incredible achievement.
Thank you so much, and it's such an honor to be here with you all.
Mabruk, Omar.
Thanks, Omar. Let's start by getting your reaction to the protest by Microsoft workers that we just saw and the company's announcement of an inquiry, and put this in the context of the resistance by workers in other big tech firms that you write about in Terms of Servitude.
Yeah. I mean, first of all, what the Microsoft workers, what this campaign is doing is exactly what's needed, because I think all of us, and I don't just mean Palestinians or even just supporters of the Palestinian struggle, but all of us in this current global order are in a lot of danger, because we're under a state of affairs right now where basically these big tech companies can move with relative impunity, right? We don't have a lot of levers of pressure. They're in all aspects of life, you know, from political to civic, and they're aware of the outsized hegemony that they are practicing. And so what we're seeing now where these inevitable revelations about complicity in Palestinian colonialism and genocide come to light is that the price of that hegemony is exactly that we don't have a lot of mechanisms of accountability. And so what we need is direct action by workers like this. We need people calling out these companies, doing it in ways that are uncomfortable, that are unpredictable, and that make as much noise as possible, because otherwise everything is going to go back to the kind of complacent corporate euphemism of these, you know, faux accountability reports like what you just read a few minutes ago, right, where the companies launch their own investigations, absolve themselves of all wrongdoings. And so this is exactly the type of action that we need, and we need a lot more of it. And I commend these workers and all others in campaigns, including the No Tech for Apartheid campaign, who are showing us the way.
Yeah, absolutely. Turning to your book, a key concept in terms of servitude is what you call digital settler colonialism. Can you explain what that is and how it helps us analyze the role of big tech in Israel's efforts to erase Palestinians physically and virtually?
Yeah, thank you for that question. And so in the book, you know, I use the term digital settler colonialism, and I'm upfront about the fact that I'm not the first person to do it. Typically, it's used in a way where the digital sphere becomes an extension of physical processes of colonization. But the way that I used it, I wanted to make clear that we're seeing a colonial weaponization of digital platforms in order to continue the Zionist process of colonizing, expelling, and ultimately eliminating Palestinian life and Palestinian presence. But the way that I tweak this a little bit is that I make clear to stress that what we're experiencing is a result of direct collusion and collaboration. So that these companies, these big tech companies, you know, I look, for example, at Meta, I talk about Google, and others, they are willingly choosing to partner with Israeli colonialism and apartheid. This is an active choice on their part to facilitate this process, right? It's not inevitable. It's not something that we have no means of stopping. And so I wanted to kind of repurpose that term to emphasize that aspect of collusion so that we see that this is a result of direct choices being made that can be reversed, that can be overturned.
Yeah.
Yeah. So as we speak to you right now, Omar, there are people watching us on YouTube, which is owned by Google, Twitch, which is owned by Amazon, Twitter or X, which is owned by Elon Musk, and Facebook, which is owned by Meta, which is controlled by Mark Zuckerberg. And we are constantly aware that anything we might say could fall afoul of these corporations' so-called community standards or community guidelines or terms of service. And of course, the title of your book, Terms of Servitude, is a play on that phrase, terms of service. In fact, the Electronic Intifada has repeatedly been censored by various platforms, including having videos arbitrarily removed by YouTube. In your book, you call these community guidelines and terms of service weapons of colonial erasure. What do you mean by that? Talk about who makes these rules and how they're enforced.
So simply put, I'm arguing that these so-called terms of service, these so-called community standards, are weapons of colonial erasure precisely because they're being levied in such a way as to silence rightful, legitimate protest and advocacy for Palestine, or often even merely documentation of Israeli colonial atrocities from their platforms. They're designed by the companies themselves, so there's very little accountability in terms of who actually is able to make much of a difference in terms of getting these processes reversed. Now, individuals can petition companies. You know, they can say, I believe my content was falsely removed, and you can go through an entire labyrinthine process. But oftentimes, it's not a guarantee you're going to get your post back. And when you do, the damage is often already done. You know, you've lost the momentum of the moment. You may have sacrificed a lot of views. And so, you know, in a sense, even with a retroactive restoration, what's happening is that the most necessary impact that the post would have been able to have has already been taken away. And this has become so routinized and so mechanized that I believe it's important to think about these things, not just as a kind of banal sort of risk of navigating the digital sphere, but they're actually an entrenched strategy for silencing and stifling political dissent and critique. And I think it's interesting that if we think back, for example, to say 2021, when we started to see uprisings for Sheikh Jarrah, as you all have reported on, as I'm sure your viewers will remember, it was kind of a revelation that we started to see these companies come forward and say, we're not really mass censoring, it's just a glitch. But since that time, and this is what I get into in the book, this has become so standard at this point that we've sort of reached this impasse where I think a lot of us are aware that these companies are lying. They're aware that what they're saying is not satisfactory, but they're also aware, you know, that we're sort of held hostage to their platforms because they're so entrenched in everything. They know that, you know, we don't have a lot of options in terms of other places to turn to. And I mean, this is the importance of, you know, Cory Doctorow talks about in crapification, not sure if I can use the actual term on this platform, right? But this idea that the companies willingly make decisions that are deleterious for their users under full awareness that we are kind of held hostage to them and we don't have much else to do. But in this case, in addition to this political censorship, you know, I'm arguing that these policies, these often non-explanatory, non-helpful policies really are their own tools of colonial erasure, precisely because they're so quotidian and yet they're so insidious at the same time in how they silence.
You talk about, just elaborate a little bit, you talk about a number of platforms over recent years, recent times, starting to include the word Zionism as one you can't say, that if you criticize Zionism in certain contexts, not in every context, they will consider that a violation, they will consider that discrimination against Jews. And you give the example of one platform, Twitch, which we said was, which as I noted, is owned by Amazon. Actually, last week during our live stream, Twitch took us offline and they claimed that we had violated one of their rules. And while we were online, we lodged an appeal very quickly. We went online and lodged an appeal. And within minutes, we got a reply, or by the time the show ended, we got a reply telling us, oh, we're sorry, we made a mistake, we've put your channel back up. They actually took down our channel. But by that time, our live stream had been canceled, had been removed. We lost viewers, but then they put it back and they said it was a mistake. But they never told us in that initial notice what they claim our violation was. And again, as I said, they put it back and they said it was a mistake. When I read your book yesterday, I reflected on that because in the book you talk about how they often claim these things are mistakes. What do you read into that? And talk again about how they're addressing the term Zionism now as a potential violation.
So the application of, you know, what some have referred to as, you know, anti-Zionist policies, moderation policies, I mean, I think a lot of us are going to be familiar with this as a direct extension of what we've seen in other contexts of Palestine work, where there's this conflation of anti-Semitism and anti-Zionism, right? This false conflation. And so what these companies do now is this very shrewd practice of claiming that they're concerned with, being vigilant about bigotry on their platform. So exactly, you know, they implement these policies that are restrictions around criticism of Zionism. And they say, really only to make sure that Zionism is not being used as a proxy, you know, for Jewish people. And of course, we've seen this. Actually, one of the companies I talk about in the book is Meta, but we've seen this multiple times from Meta, right, where you had campaigns from organizations like Jewish Voice for Peace, you know, the Facebook We Need to Talk campaign that I believe was in 2020, which was to prevent what is now Meta, right, from implementing a policy restricting criticism of Zionist and Zionism on its platforms. Well, since that time, now that has become a standard policy that was implemented, right? And again, of course, if you take the time to read them, there's these confusing, mealy-mouthed explanations about all of the different contexts under which they might censor use of the term Zionist, right? But of course, we know that this is not a good faith or transparent policy that's really rooted in, you know, protecting their users. I mean, if, you know, these companies were concerned with protecting their users, we wouldn't see the mass censorship of Palestinians in times of genocide and even prior atrocities that have been playing out for years, right? We know that this is an attempt basically to capitulate to Zionism because these companies believe and know that this is what's best for their bottom line. But oftentimes they will, you know, disguise these policies as trying to prevent anti-Semitism on their platforms. And then the, you know, alibi of this being a mistake, it's, again, you know, to get back to this kind of shrewd play, this kind of gives them the best of both worlds. If they can say, okay, we apologize, this was a mistake on our part, you know, what they're actually doing is, it might seem like they're admitting fault, but actually they're affirming the strength of their platform. Because in this moment, they're saying, you know, we're so vigilant, sometimes we just overstep a little bit because we really care about our users so much, right? So it's actually a way of kind of validating themselves. It, secondly, it does let them off the hook because they don't really need to get into the mechanisms of how their censorship works, right? And oftentimes companies will practice kind of a twinned sort of opaque strategy that combines a lot of algorithmic targeting with some cases where you have individual flagging as well, but they try to keep this very, very hidden in the shadows so we're not aware of it. But so the idea of being a mistake is a very clever ploy, you know, because it ultimately lets them get themselves off the hook while patting themselves on the back and ultimately minimizing the accountability that they have to us as users who, let's be frank, are providing the direct content, you know, that makes their platform so successful to begin with.
And if you could flesh that out even a little more in terms of the actual direct connections by, you know, Meta, Amazon, Google, to Israeli intelligence, to the military, you know, manufacturers. You know, it's not just like ideological support of Israel's settler colonial violence and genocide of Gaza, but it is absolutely a financial tie as well. And then you have people on the board of these organizations or in top, you know, executive positions who come from, you know, Israeli intelligence, who come from the Israeli government. You know, can you talk a little bit about like these material connections to the Israeli state and how that fits into, you know, their policies on policing speech and censoring Palestinians?
Mm-hmm. Yeah. You know, you try to keep receipts of this. And then I think one of the importance of revelations like what we're seeing most recently about Microsoft, for example, is that you find that this is actually so entrenched that one kind of wonders where to start, you know, and where it really stops. I mean, just thinking, for example, about how many veterans of 8200 are entrenched in the tech industry. And this is something that's also cynically used often as a branding ploy by big tech, right? But the numbers, I mean, I was just looking at DropSite News, for example. You see about 250 veterans in Microsoft. And then, of course, you have, you know, in other multinational companies, NVIDIA, Meta, Google, Intel, Apple. and which often actively continue to employ veterans of that unit on the boards of these companies like Meta. You have people with direct, you know, who are Israeli, right? And so this is also an important thing to think through, because I kind of relate this to thinking about the question of the lobby, right? We often have we talk about whether or not the Israeli lobby controls and dictates, U.S. media. And very quickly, I just want to note for the viewers that may not be aware, Unit 8200 is this shadowy cyber unit that is responsible for direct surveillance, as well as creation of, you know, the many of the fatal algorithmic AI targeting platforms that we're seeing unleashed in Gaza right now. So they're often compared to the NSA within the U.S. context. Just wanted to put that out there for those who may not be familiar. So there is a lot of Israeli entrenchment, you know, in various capacities within big tech. But I also think, you know, this is why I like to emphasize the question of collusion and collaboration, because we need to remind ourselves, I think we can kind of go down the rabbit hole of mapping all of these connections, and they are important to map, but we also need to be aware that this is a direct result of a choice that is made. You know, these companies don't need to partner in the ways that they do. They don't need to go to one of the most elite repression units, you know, of a colonial government in order to bolster their products. They choose to do this because it's the best for their bottom line, and because they know, or they believe, that maximal profits have no connection to the preservation of human rights. And so I do think there's a lot of material connection. And this is directly tied to profit. This explains why the companies orient themselves often in the way that they do, where Zionism is taken for granted, whereas Palestinian humanity is controversial, is something that is terrifying to them. And they create this cultural interaction and experience that really internalizes that, so that, you know, what started as the advantage to these platforms being the so-called exception to corporate media, they're recreating the internalized biases of corporate media and operationalizing that as practice. But again, I think we really need to remind ourselves of the fact that they are choosing to operate in the way that they do. There's nothing inevitable about this. There's nothing duplicitous or deceptive, you know, in terms of them being deceived. They know what they are doing, and they're doing it to us, and they are doing it willingly.
And I just want to remind people, Omar, that during the 12-day war in June, which came after Israel launched its aggression on Iran, one of the targets Iran retaliated against was this Israeli cyber warfare base in Beersheba in the Naqab region. And of course, this was heavily censored in Israeli media. We reported on it. And this is a base, this is a major project designed by the Israeli army, the Israeli military, with a number of purposes. One, explicitly, is to settle the Naqab, the Negev Desert, to bring Jews to the Negev by moving major military base and industries there. And then if you look at the list of tenants on this Israeli military base, you can see there it includes some of the firms we're talking about: Amazon, Apple, IBM, Google, Microsoft, Philips, Dell, Intel, Nvidia. These are all Western firms, Motorola. And they all chose to locate their Israel offices, and others, European firms like Siemens and so on, Oracle,
Pfizer, yeah.
And there at the bottom, you see the two logos, a little bit hard to see, but they are the logos of the Israeli Defense Ministry and the Israeli Prime Minister's office in this major multi-billion dollar Israeli military project to combine Unit 8200 that you just talked about with these tech firms. So they made the choice to go there and be part of a military target which Iran struck during its war. So that's a very stark reminder of those material and organic ties and the choices that they've made. So Omar, there's a fascinating quote in terms of servitude. It says, and I don't recall exactly who it's from, but it says, this is a quote, there's this feeling Palestinians are going viral, but they're also somehow invisible at the same time. And I think we can all intuitively understand that. Please talk about how we can resolve the contradiction that these big tech firms are actively collaborating with Israel's erasure of Palestinians, while at the same time we're witnessing a live stream genocide through these same platforms. It's sort of a paradox that you address, but talk about it now.
It's a great question, and it's one that I still sit with, you know, well after completing this book, precisely because it's the one that we're all living through. But one thing that definitely comes to mind is that we need to act on the difference that an raised consciousness is supposed to provide. And what I mean by that is there is a virality, there is an awareness, there's no undoing the awareness of what we're seeing right now is genocide and only the latest genocide. There's no undoing the awareness of the fact that Palestinians are facing a horrendous and frankly inhuman level of oppression by a brutal and irredeemable colonial force. And so what needs to happen now is we need to continue acting out and disrupting in all of the ways that we can. You know, at the very beginning, right after the latest genocide was unleashed, you know, this apocalyptic hell was rained down on Palestinians. One of the things that, you know, people would say at protests was there can be no business as usual under a genocide. I think a lot of us may have had some level of shock that not necessarily that things would continue on as usual, but that they would do so to the extent that they have. And I think part of it is for us to kind of not wake ourselves up, because I think we're awake, but to continue to wake others up and to continue to find points of pressure and agitate and continue to make that saying, you know, that that imperative that there can be no business as usual under a genocide a reality. And so continuing to do the next step from raising consciousness, whatever that looks like, whatever form it takes, I think that's the most important thing we can be doing in this moment. Because otherwise, I think the flip side of that is relapsing to despair and despondency, which will not help the struggle, will not help our movement, and which is frankly not what we're being called on to do by Palestinians in Gaza as well.
Omar, speaking of Palestinians in Gaza, in the book, you interview Assam Anabi. He's the engineer and writer in Gaza, a frequent contributor to the Electronic Intifada and someone that we've been honored to host on this live stream. What did you learn from him and from people in Gaza more generally about the interplay between their lives and technology under Israel's siege for almost two decades, and now during almost 2 years of this ongoing Holocaust?
Well, I learned so much from Assam, but I think one thing that surprised me a little bit is that, you know, when we began our interview and I told him, well, you know, so this is, I'm speaking about tech suppression and the use of digital platforms to advance the Palestinian struggle. And at one point, he told me something to the effect of, we've won. And I found myself, you know, being a little confused. And I said, well, what do you mean? Because here I was doing this interview at a time where there's this imposed famine and honestly feeling horrible on some level, because I'm interviewing somebody who is going through this and having them give me their time to speak about what they're enduring, you know. And he tells me, no, we've won. And I say, okay, what do you mean? He's like, no, we've used these platforms to raise consciousness. People know Palestine because of what we have done and what we in Gaza have done on many levels. You know, and then, you know, through talking to Assam, that was one of the most crucial interviews in really locking down the process by which Palestinians had very strategically taken to platforms like what we call it X now, but Twitter at the time, right? And done so with a very careful and sophisticated understanding of the conventions of narrative and kind of, you know, cross-purposing these platforms to raise awareness about, you know, Israeli strikes and things like that. Knowing when and how things would go viral, we said this was the process of many, many years. And so what we're seeing now is the result of decades of work by people in Gaza. So we have to thank everybody in Gaza, whoever took out their phone, right? And that really sat with me, that sense of no matter how dire things seem in the moment, whatever consciousness we have now really is the result of what Palestinians, you know, on the ground have done. So that was a huge takeaway. And I also think it would be important to our conversation just to emphasize Awesome's point that, you know, oftentimes Palestinians in Gaza can be dehumanized. You know, people, he says, people just see us as, you know, these suffering victims or these perfect victims, and they don't recognize that we have full lives. We're human beings, you know, that we have joy, that we have not just resilience, not just resistance, but also our families, you know, our friends, our loved ones, and we have this fullness that these representations often don't do justice to. And so I think that that was really important to hear in the moment. And, you know, I really thank Awesome for sharing that with me. And I think one of the most important aspects of our work needs to be to continue to affirm that point as well.
Mm. Yeah, that was a really thought-provoking and moving chapter of the book, your conversation with Awesome, including the conversation about how Dr. Rifat al-Ar'ir, who was, of course, murdered in the first months of this genocide, played such a huge role and in making this very deliberate effort for Palestinians to adopt these technologies and speak to the world, and how successful that has been. And really, that's ultimately why Israel murdered him, just as it is systematically murdering journalists in Gaza. It's murdering anyone who can bear witness or show others how to bear witness. So I just was so moved by the way you connected this to the reality of people in Gaza. I think it's often easy to speak in abstracts, particularly when we're talking about technology, and you really tied it to what's happening right now. We have one more question for you, but of course I want you to feel free to add anything else you think that we should know or you want people to know about your book or about this topic. But my question really is that Terms of Servitude chronicles this very sobering reality of tech censorship and repression targeting Palestine and Palestinians. Yet at the same time, you are optimistic that this repression will not succeed. Talk about where that optimism comes from and what are some of the ways you see people effectively fighting back, and what more should we be doing?
Yeah, I think we need to understand, I think, that whenever we're despairing or we're feeling that we're powerless or that there's nothing we can do, we need to ask ourselves, who does that feeling benefit? And I think I always find that helpful, because in these moments it really reorients my understanding of the fact that companies, the Israeli colonial project, and the entities that support it, right, need us to feel powerless. They need us to think that there's nothing we can do. And so the optimism for me often comes from the fact that even if we just do one thing differently.
That was the Electronic Intifada dealing with the topic of the kind of surveillance and technology that was provided by companies like Microsoft to help the Israelis in their mass murder of Palestinians and in the targeting of journalists, writers, poets, doctors, students, children, etc. And again, I just wanted to tell you, in the wake of this cataloging of miseries, basically, that people are fighting back and fighting back effectively. As I mentioned, there are encampments right now outside of these Microsoft offices, and there are actions happening nationwide. Thank you, and we'll be talking to you again next Wednesday at 2 p.m. This is Zain Lamine signing off with the Shai Onana Show.
For WPFW News in Washington and WBAI in New York, I'm Sue Goodwin. Here are some headlines. In a breaking news story, there are multiple victims from a shooting that took place at the Annunciation Catholic School in Minneapolis this morning. Two children have been reported killed and 17 other people injured after a gunman opened fire on school children who were attending Mass. The full extent of the injuries is not yet clear. Children's Minnesota, a local hospital system, said it was treating seven children. Minneapolis police said the attacker died from a self-inflicted gunshot wound. Authorities believe he was in his early 20s, did not have an extensive criminal history, and acted alone. The police did not release his name or say if he had a connection to the church. He was believed to have used three weapons: a rifle, a shotgun, and a pistol. Police are still searching for a motive. In other news, President Trump recently reinstated an additional process to the process of becoming a U.S. citizen. WPFW's Noah Portner has more.
Just yesterday, the Trump administration announced that it is activating a decades-old process of interviews for prospective U.S. citizens. These so-called neighborhood checks have not been used since the presidency of George H.W. Bush and involve the State Department conducting interviews with neighbors and co-workers. These on-the-ground investigations are allegedly supposed to ensure that new citizens are, quote, well-disposed to the good order and happiness of the United States, end quote. This latest announcement is part of President Trump's pattern of restricting legal immigration, freezing the refugee admissions program, and adding additional barriers for green cards and citizenship. Some experts in the field call these checks a rarely beneficial waste of time, insisting that criminal background checks and the mandated civics test are enough. From WPFW News, I'm Noah Portner.
In more news, the Department of Government Efficiency may have put Americans' personal information at risk. According to a whistleblower complaint filed by the chief data officer at the Social Security Administration, a former senior DOGE officer, now at Social Security, created a live copy of Social Security records for more than 300 million Americans and uploaded the data in a cloud environment that did not have independent security controls that would allow the host to see who was accessing the data and how they were using it. According to the complaint, the copy of the database contained people's names, social security numbers, dates of birth, addresses, citizenship status, parents' names, and other personal information, potentially putting an enormous amount of private information at risk to being revealed and possibly used by identity thieves. And after FEMA employees signed a letter on Monday criticizing the Trump administration, several employees have now been placed on leave. Here again is WPFW's Noah Portner.
Yesterday, over 30 employees at the Federal Emergency Management Agency, or FEMA, said that they were put on leave for speaking out against the current administration. On Monday, 191 FEMA employees signed an open letter criticizing changes to the agency and warning that FEMA's ability